Chapter 4. The whale tooth. It was in the early days in Fiji when John Starhurst arose in the mission house at Rewa village and announced his intention of carrying the gospel throughout all Vidilevu. Now Vidilevu means the reed land, it being the largest island in a group composed of many large islands, to say nothing of hundreds of small ones. Here and there on the coasts, living by most precarious tenure, was a sprinkling of missionaries, traders, beachy demer fishers, and whaleship deserters. The smoke of the hot ovens arose under their windows, and the bodies of the slain were dragged by their doors on the way to the feasting. The ladu, or the worship, was progressing slowly and, often, in crab-like fashion. Chiefs, who announced themselves Christians, and were welcomed into the body of the chapel, had a distressing habit of backsliding in order to partake of the flesh of some favorite enemy. Eat or be eaten had been the law of the land, and eat or be eaten promised to remain the law of the land for a long time to come. There were chiefs, such as Tanoa, Tuvakoso, and Tikilakila, who had literally eaten hundreds of their fellow men. But among these gluttons Rondrunder ranked highest. Rondrunder lived at Takaraki. He kept a register of his gustatory exploits. A row of stones outside his house marked the bodies he had eaten. This row was 230 paces long, and the stones in it numbered 872. Each stone represented a body. The row of stones might have been longer, had not Rondrunder unfortunately received a spear in the small of his back in a bush skirmish on Somo Somo, and been served upon the table of Ningavili, whose mediocre string of stones numbered only 48. The hard-worked, fever-stricken missionaries stuck doggedly to their task, at times despairing, and looking forward for some special manifestation, some outburst of Pentecostal fire that would bring a glorious harvest of souls. But cannibal Fiji had remained obdurate. The frizzle-headed man-eaters were loath to leave their flesh pots so long as the harvest of human carcasses was plentiful. Sometimes, when the harvest was too plentiful, they imposed on the missionaries, by letting the word slip out that on such a day there would be a killing and a barbecue. Promptly the missionaries would buy the lives of the victims with stick tobacco, fathoms of calico, and quarts of trade beads. Nathless the chiefs drove a handsome trade in thus disposing of their surplus live meat. Also, they could always go out and catch more. It was at this juncture that John Starhurst proclaimed that he would carry the gospel from coast to coast of the great land, and that he would begin by penetrating the mountain fastnesses of the headwaters of the Rewa River. His words were received with consternation. The native teachers wept softly. His two fellow missionaries strove to dissuade him. The king of Rewa warned him that the mountain dwellers would surely kai-kai him, kai-kai meaning o eat, and that he, the king of Rewa, having become ladu, would be put to the necessity of going to war with the mountain dwellers. That he could not conquer them, he was perfectly aware. That they might come down the river and sack Rewa village, he was likewise perfectly aware. But what was he to do? If John Starhurst persisted in going out and being eaten, there would be a war that would cost hundreds of lives. Later in the day, a deputation of Rewa chiefs waited upon John Starhurst. He heard them patiently, and argued patiently with them, though he abated not a whit from his purpose. To his fellow missionaries he explained that he was not bent upon martyrdom, that the call had come for him to carry the gospel into Vidilevu, and that he was merely obeying the Lord's wish. To the traders who came and objected most strenuously of all, he said, "Your objections are valueless. They consist merely of the damage that may be done your businesses. You are interested in making money, but I am interested in saving souls. The heathen of this dark land must be saved." John Starhurst was not a fanatic. He would have been the first man to deny the imputation. He was eminently sane and practical. He was sure that his mission would result in good, and he had private visions of igniting the Pentecostal spark in the souls of the mountaineers, and of inaugurating a revival that would sweep down out of the mountains, and across the length and breadth of the great land from sea to sea, and to the isles in the midst of the sea. There were no wild lights in his mild gray eyes, but only calm resolution and an unfaltering trust in the higher power that was guiding him. One man only he found who approved of his project, and that was Ravadu, who secretly encouraged him, and offered to lend him guides to the first foothills. John Starhurst, in turn, was greatly pleased by Ravadu's conduct. From an incorrigible heathen, with a heart as black as his practices, Ravadu was beginning to emanate light. He even spoke of becoming Ladu. True, 3 years before he had expressed a similar intention, and would have entered the church had not John Starhurst entered objection to his bringing his four wives along with him. Ravadu had had economic and ethical objections to monogamy. Besides, the missionary's hair-splitting objection had offended him, and, to prove that he was a free agent and a man of honor, he had swung his huge war club over Starhurst's head. Starhurst had escaped by rushing in under the club and holding on to him until help arrived. But all that was now forgiven and forgotten. Ravadu was coming into the church, not merely as a converted heathen, but as a converted polygamist as well. He was only waiting, he assured Starhurst, until his oldest wife, who was very sick, should die. John Starhurst journeyed up the sluggish Rewai in one of Ravadu's canoes. This canoe was to carry him for 2 days. When the head of navigation reached, it would return. Far in the distance, lifted into the sky, could be seen the great Smoky Mountains that marked the backbone of the great land. All day John Starhurst gazed at them with eager yearning. Sometimes he prayed silently. At other times he was joined in prayer by Nera, a native teacher, who for 7 years had been Ladu, ever since the day he had been saved from the hot oven by Dr. James Ellery Brown at the trifling expense of 100 sticks of tobacco, 2 cotton blankets, and a large bottle of painkiller. At the last moment, after 20 hours of solitary supplication and prayer, Nera's ears had heard the call to go forth with John Starhurst on the mission to the mountains. "Master, I will surely go with thee," he had announced. John Starhurst had hailed him with sober delight. Truly, the Lord was with him thus, to spur on so broken-spirited a creature as Nera. "I am indeed without spirit, the weakest of the Lord's vessels," Nera explained, the first day in the canoe. "You should have faith, stronger faith," the missionary chided him. Another canoe journeyed up the Rewa that day. But it journeyed an hour astern, and it took care not to be seen. This canoe was also the property of Ravadu. In it was Arola, Ravadu's first cousin and trusted henchman. And in the small basket, that never left his age, and was a whale tooth. It was a magnificent tooth, fully 6 inches long, beautifully proportioned, the ivory turned yellow and purple with age. This tooth was likewise the property of Ravadu, and in Fiji, when such a tooth goes forth, things usually happen. For this is the virtue of the whale tooth. Whoever accepts it cannot refuse the request that may accompany it or follow it. The request may be anything from a human life to a tribal alliance, and no Fijian is so dead to honor as to deny the request when once the tooth has been accepted. Sometimes the request hangs fire, or the fulfillment is delayed, with untoward consequences. High up the Rewa, at the village of a chief, Mongondro by name, John Starhurst rested at the end of the second day of the journey. In the morning, attended by Nera, he expected to start on foot for the Smoky Mountains, that were now green and velvety with nearness. Mongondro was a sweet-tempered, mild-mannered little old chief, short-sighted and afflicted with elephantiasis, and no longer inclined toward the turbulence of war. He received the missionary with warm hospitality, gave him food from his own table, and even discussed religious matters with him. Mongondro was of an inquiring bent of mind, and pleased John Starhurst greatly by asking him to account for the existence and beginning of things. When the missionary had finished his summary of the creation according to Genesis, he saw that Mongondro was deeply affected. The little old chief smoked silently for some time. Then he took the pipe from his mouth and shook his head sadly. "It cannot be," he said. I, Mongondro, in my youth, was a good workman with the axe. Yet 3 months did it take me to make a canoe, a small canoe, a very small canoe. And you say that all this land and water was made by one man, nay, was made by one God, the only true God," the missionary interrupted. "It is the same thing," Mongondro went on, "that all the land and all the water, the trees, the fish, and bush and mountains, the sun, the moon, and the stars, were made in 6 days. No, no. I tell you that in my youth I was an able man, yet did it require me 3 months for one small canoe. It is a story to frighten children with, but no man can believe it." "I am a man," the missionary said. "True, you are a man. But it is not given to my dark understanding to know what you believe. I tell you, I do believe that everything was made in 6 days." So you say, the old cannibal murmured soothingly. It was not until after John Starhurst and Nera had gone off to bed that Arola crept into the chief's house, and, after diplomatic speech, handed the whale tooth to Mongondro. The old chief held the tooth in his hands for a long time. It was a beautiful tooth, and he yearned for it. Also, he divined the request that must accompany it. And no, whale teeth were beautiful, and his mouth watered for it, but he passed it back to Arola with many apologies. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.